This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And they did it. They actually did it. In a moment, a look at what it means for the Senate to have changed the rules on filibusters in the way of judicial appointments, the so-called nuclear option. Let me tell you, it may not mean that the Senate is now going to run as smoothly like the congressional equivalent of a Swiss watch. Also this hour, how our traditional notions of language and communication are in some serious flux right now. How is the teaching of writing being disrupted or assisted by the advent of Facebook? And young people writing more than ever, in a sense, not just with traditional topic sentences. They're, you know, using emoticons. Two teachers will share their observations of this turmoil between text culture and traditional writing. What are your observations? Have digital media put your writing or your kids' writing skills on life support with crutches and mind respirator tools like spell check? Is anything longer than a paragraph War and Peace to you these days? Have social media made you or your kids better or worse writers? Also, how technology and our understanding of how the world works may be redefining what constitutes an act of God these days. It's more of a legal matter than a theological matter when we can see the human impacts in climate and in the places we choose to live. But first, to Washington, where the Senate has changed the rules on filibusters. That's right.
Is the Senate working now? Can anyone say the Senate is working now? I don't think so. Today, Democrats and independents are saying enough is enough. To change the rules regarding presidential nominees will apply equally to both parties. When Republicans are in power, these changes will apply to them just as well. That, Mr. President, is simple fairness.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, right there just before a vote today, striking down the rules on filibusters for judicial appointments. The bipartisan doctrine of mutually assured filibuster seems to have broken down. Does this mean that business will fundamentally change in the Senate? Rules that protect individual senators and minority parties and alliances, are they going to be ditched altogether? Joining us now is Gregory Warrow, professor of political science at Columbia University, author of the book Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Welcome to the program, Gregory.
Thank you for having me on.
How amazed are you that they actually did this?
I'm slightly amazed. If you look at the history of the Senate, I think this has been coming for a while. I'm surprised. It's surprising that Republicans sought to test the Democrats again so quickly after what happened this summer with executive branch nominees and how quickly the Democrats were able to hold together the coalition that they needed to in order to invoke the nuclear option.
And when you say nuclear option, we've talked about that before on this program. Why is it a nuclear option? And why, as you've said before, does it maybe create more problems than it solves?
Well, the term has evolved to mean different things to different people, but essentially it boils down to changing the rules in the Senate through an unconventional but not unprecedented parliamentary maneuver. So I think the term nuclear has different dimensions here, but one of the dimensions that I think the Democrats have been worried about and may need to worry about more is what the Republican response will be. Will the Republicans now use their the extensive individual prerogatives that individual senators have to cause some collateral damage? Are they going to obstruct other items of business that the Democrats want to obstruct in retaliation for the Democrats' move to go nuclear on judicial nominations?
Well, you say collateral damage, and that's exactly the next question. I mean, how much of this can be contained to judicial appointments? Is it likely that this whole dispute is really going to spread everywhere else into the Senate's business?
Well, I think that this move is historical, as people are saying, and I think it does put the Senate on a path now to become or return to, I should say, its status as a majoritarian institution. The Senate has essentially been a super majoritarian institution for the past 30 or 40 years. And now that we have majority cloture on judicial nominations, this doesn't apply to Supreme Court nominations, it's lower court nominations. But I think that probably will be the next step if there is controversy over a future Supreme Court nominee. And then the next step after that would be applying it to particular pieces of legislation.
Well, the particular nomination that motivated all of this today is in the D.C. Circuit, which is a unique court. It's a very important court. And so it's not surprising that this court and its nominations and its makeup and its balance, which has been an issue for years, should motivate all this. I guess what I'm wondering is, because some people call this option the constitutional option, isn't it the case that the Constitution supports a majoritarian Senate as well as a Senate that has a supermajority kind of approach that we've seen up until now?
Yes, I think there are arguments on both sides with respect to the constitutionality of the filibuster and supermajority cloture. While the framers rejected supermajoritarianism in some ways and accepted it in others, for example, a two-thirds vote for the override of a veto or two-thirds for changing the Constitution, the Constitution also says that the Senate and the House can make their own rules. And so if either chamber wants to adopt supermajority provisions, they can do so. I mean, the House has supermajority provisions in the sense that the motion to suspend the rules requires a two-thirds vote in support. So the House can operate in supermajority mode just like the Senate can.
Now, can I possibly take your political science hat off here and your historian hat off here and turn you into a pundit for just a second?
You can try.
All right. I'm wondering if the reading of Green Eggs and Ham by Ted Cruz in any sense eroded the sanctity of the filibuster, and that's one of the steps that brought us here?
I would say no. I think, you know, what Ted Cruz did was what lots of senators have done in the past. I think this is really about the Republicans' staunch opposition to these particular nominees. I think that, you know, what Ted Cruz did was it was largely just showmanship. But this is really about the kinds of policymaking decisions that come out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
But the Jimmy Stewart days of heroic filibusters, they seem to be completely over.
Oh, they've been over for many years. The Senate has been operating via silent filibuster for many years, over a decade now. And I just think that that contributes to part of this in the sense that the ease with which senators could filibuster makes it more a more attractive weapon, and so it gets used more.
Gregory Walro is professor of political science at Columbia University, author of the book Filibuster: Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Global story now, a war between the North and the South, not in the way you might think. The war between the states in the 21st century involves some very old battles between rich industrial nations of the North and poor countries associated with the Southern Hemisphere. United Nations-sponsored climate talks in Warsaw have divided along lines that may recall Cold War-era battles between developed and developing nations. Representatives from some of the world's poorest countries staged a walkout after it became clear that the U.S., the EU, Australia, and other developed nations were not going to discuss payment for extreme environmental damage, such as the aftermath of the recent typhoon in the Philippines. Isaac Valero is the European Union spokesman for climate action. Isaac, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Is this a good guy, bad guy kind of dispute that's going on between the North and the South?
No, it is definitely not, and it shouldn't be portrayed that way. Of course, there are issues between developed and developing countries. We're sitting around the table to try to seal a deal to reduce emissions, reduce carbon emissions of producing human-induced climate change, but it's definitely not that. There are positive forces within in both camps, if you like. There are, for example, South Africa and developing countries helping a lot. There is the EU. There is the small island states in the developing countries. So it is not like a develop as it's being portrayed at all.
But shouldn't this issue of compensation be on the table on some level?
Well, it is on the table. We're still discussing the different modalities and how can we just get an agreement here. The most important thing, and this is a red line for both the European Union and the U.S., is that we can't just ask for compensation for any extreme weather event occurring in the world. First of all, because, yes, scientists have been able to predict that the intensity and the frequency of extreme weather events will be increased due to climate change, But no one at these states can point to, for example, if the typhoon in the recent typhoon in the Philippines was due to climate change. So it is important that developing countries get the climate finance to adapt to the severe impacts of climate change. But we also have to be careful not to get dragged into an ideological debate on who is paying for what, for historical compensation, etc.
Where is this likely to go? You mentioned modalities before, and I'm wondering if you'll be candid enough with me to engage in a bit of a hypothetical discussion. I mean, are we talking about a solution here that would involve some sort of huge endowment to deal with climate change kinds of issues that everyone would contribute to and would maybe mostly go to poor nations? Or are we talking about a climate court that would actually adjudicate compensation issues? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid that I won't be very hypothetical here because there are ongoing negotiations at the moment as we talk. But for the moment, there are two parts here. There are some developing countries who are asking for this, and they should put on the table how they feel this should be addressed through a new institution, through a new mechanism, through a group, through a court. How can we feel that we can address this problem? The EU believes that we have enough institutions. We don't need a new institution dealing with this. What it matters at the end of the day is that the money flows to the developing countries so that they can adapt to climate change, and we don't need new institutions for that.
But what about an endowment of some kind, a fund that essentially would be put to this purpose?
As I said, an endowment or a fund, what is important is that money flows. We'll need to see how can we get this money going there. This is being under discussions for the moment. You, for example, mentioned a court. I don't see this happening at all.
All right. So the takeaway here is the EU is opposed to a new court and possibly even opposed to a kind of international climate monetary fund kind of institution as well. No new institutions. Yeah. Do it with what we have.
I mean, it is just a speculation. I mean, it's not that we are opposing on the different ideas. What I said is that I don't see a court happening. I don't see the concept materializing. I don't see any sort of like idea solid enough to be addressed at a high level. What I'm saying is that it is important, and we have to understand that developing countries are already affected by climate change. So they're going through the severe impacts of climate change. We also have to understand that they're very sensitive and also they're frustrated with this slow pace of negotiations, and sometimes because the money they feel is not coming as fast as they should. But what we also have to understand, as I said before, is that it is important for them and for us to understand that we can't just compensate for any extreme weather event. It is simply feasible.
All right, Isaac Valero, I pushed. You pushed back. Thanks for your candor.
All right. Thank you so much.
Isaac Valero is the EU spokesman for climate action, speaking to us from the climate talks in Warsaw, Poland. Battling teachers later this hour, is technology helping or hindering the teaching of writing with all this social media? What do you think?
Deb, I'm calling from Carrollton, Texas. It probably does make me a better writer because I do it more often than anything. And it's one of the only places to see my writing over and over. So I do tend to correct the grammatic errors more often than not.
Mike Becker on Facebook feels it's a losing battle for him. As an English educator, I feel it has only made our writing skills worse. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Just make sure your posts are grammatically correct, okay? You know, think about it for a minute. I mean, when there's an ongoing international discussion of compensation from nations that may have created the conditions for extreme storms like that typhoon in the Philippines, then you're really no longer talking about the traditional act of God as an explanation for the sudden destruction wrought by natural disasters. Such explanations may be irresistible in times of great tragedy, as when Governor Chris Christie tried to console the people of New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy.
The people of New Jersey are in need, and not from their own actions, but from an act of God that delivered a natural, human, and financial disaster.
What is an act of God in our time? And will this idea eventually be obsolete based on our scientific understanding of how humans are changing the Earth? Joining us now is Ted Steinberg, professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University and the author of Acts of God, The Unnatural History of Natural Disaster in America. Professor, welcome.
Hi, John.
I want to note your forthcoming book is all about the ecological history of Greater New York. Would you refer to Sandy as an act of God in your upcoming book?
No, I wouldn't, John. I don't think that's a particularly helpful way of thinking about these sorts of events. When Sandy happened, actually, Chris Christie aside, the reality is that there was more talk about the role of Mother Nature, which is the secular equivalent of an act of God. These sorts of statements, the city can't control Mother Nature, are not helpful. They're a form, in my opinion, of moral hand-washing.
And what is the history of the notion of an act of God in, say, insurance settlements and compensation for disasters down through history?
Well, my feeling is that this is an attempt to shed responsibility. It's fine, I think, for people and understandable for people to invoke God in order to come to grips with a difficult event like a natural calamity. But when public leaders invoke this kind of language, it's problematic for several reasons. And Sandy's a good example. I mean, the reality is that God and nature had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that despite all the property and people at risk in greater New York from a storm like Sandy, the Army Corps of Engineers had no comprehensive flood protection study, had done no comprehensive flood protection study up to this point. The FEMA maps of the New York area were hopelessly out of date. And, of course, it had been known for some time that New York was highly exposed to coastal flooding, and its level of defense was just a fraction of the level of defense in places like London, Amsterdam, Tokyo, Shanghai, and others.
And so as we know more about how climate has an impact on the places where humans choose to live, does the legal definition of an act of God go away? And does liability just fundamentally increase? Because one can come up with any number of scenarios for responsibility for various destruction.
Well, the legal aspects of this are not something that I've studied in any real detail. What I'm mostly focused on in my work is the ways in which these sorts of statements, this kind of rhetoric, act of God, act of nature, the role of Mother Nature in these kinds of scenarios is invoked to shed responsibility for things that could have been done and could have been avoided. And I think Hurricane Katrina actually is a good example of what I'm talking about here. After the disaster, Dick Cheney flew to Louisiana in 2005 and said things like, we need to recognize the severity of what Mother Nature has done to us here. But Mother Nature had nothing to do with the fact that the Bush administration had cut funds for urban flood control just a few years before in order to fund the war in Iraq. Mother Nature had nothing to do with the fact that the Bush administration appointed Mike Brown, a lawyer with no real emergency preparedness experience, to head up FEMA. And not for nothing, but it wasn't exactly a secret that since the 1960s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was much more interested in the economic development of wetlands than it was in the safety of the people of Louisiana. And it was also, of course, just like in New York, Hurricane Katrina, a perfectly predictable disaster. I mean, people had been talking about the possibility for mass death, which is what happened there in 2005, for years before the storm. And I actually even mentioned it in my book, which was published in 2000.
So let's just take God out of it completely. One, in hindsight, can always come up with a chain of causality that would suggest that a different level of preparedness would have changed events. But what is indeterminate in our relationship with nature and in the places that we live these days? If the weather isn't, is it just about asteroids and the sun blowing up?
Well, I'm not trying to argue that there aren't indeterminate aspects to these sorts of geophysical extremes. The wind blows, the earth shakes, things happen like that. However, the reality is that natural disasters, when they happen, are about the intersection of geophysical extremes and human history. And that's a complex interaction. And it's not going to be solved by a reliance on market imperatives and private property-driven development alone. This is where science and law, where rules and regulations have a role to play in helping to lessen the death and destruction.
We have to eliminate the blanks and really fundamentally understand what our relationship with nature is if we're going to come up with responses and not simply revert to the act of God notion there. Ted Steinberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ted Steinberg is professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University, author of the forthcoming book, Gotham Unbound, The Ecological History of Greater New York. Later this hour, the impact of texts, tweets, Facebook comments on our writing, as it helped or hurt.
Hi, my name is Carrie. I'm at Delray Beach, Florida. I'm an English teacher in college. I teach college composition 1 and 2, and writing skills of the young people today are execrable. They really have no idea how to put a sentence together or how to complete a thought, and they also have no critical faculties. This is unfortunate.
Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. And yeah, I think that technology has helped a lot in writing, especially spell check and grammar check, stuff like that. It's kind of probably helped my kids a lot to write better. But the need for speed that they seem to have when they're texting and writing kind of gets in the way of good writing a lot of times.
Better spelling through technology. Have your say at 877-8MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. One thing that we are really not responsible for as climate-modifying humans is what's going on the sun. And if you think the sun is a god, then an act of God is about to take place that does occur once every 11 years. The sun's magnetic field flips as its north magnetic pole becomes the south. Even though that is about to happen, there's a lot about the sun that has been pretty bewildering to astronomers and solar scientists lately. Here with us is Todd Hooksum, a director of the Wilcox Solar Observatory at Stanford University, which closely watches the sun's magnetic fields. Todd, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So help me to understand what is going on with the sun. It's got a bunch of cycles, and we're about to enter one, but it's also behaving in a bunch of ways that has folks like you a little bit mystified. Is the sun okay?
Yeah, the sun is doing just fine. It has a cycle every 11 years, and we're just at the point now where it's reaching its maximum intensity. The sun's cycle is a magnetic cycle, so it doesn't have a nice, stable magnetic field like the Earth does. Instead, it has magnetic storms, and the magnetic storms appear at low latitudes near the sun's equator, a little bit north or south, and they last for a few months at a time, and they're very intense. They look like sunspots. In fact, they are sunspots, and that's how it was first recognized that the sun had this cycle. It wasn't until about 100 years ago that we started measuring the magnetic field itself. And now we've realized that the sun's polar fields at high latitudes change direction about the time of solar maximum. And that's where we are right now.
Now, if the magnet flips there on the sun, what is the impact on us at all? I mean, it doesn't affect our compasses, certainly. And the magnetic fields on Earth are far more stable, apparently, than the sun's.
Well, it has big effects in what's called the heliosphere. The heliosphere is the bubble that the sun's solar wind carves out in the interstellar medium. It reaches out well beyond the farthest planets, beyond Pluto, out to the Voyager spacecraft, which have just crossed into the interstellar medium. And the sun's magnetic field direction is carried out by the solar wind at 1,000,000 miles an hour into that region. And all the planets are in that region. So what we see are a couple different effects. One is, at solar maximum, there's a lot more activity. So the Earth's magnetic field is disturbed by the magnetic field that the solar wind carries along with it. That's one effect. The one that's most directly related to the change of the polar field is cosmic rays. There are cosmic rays that are generated out in the galaxy by supernova and other processes. And the sun's solar wind acts like a shield for us. And at solar minimum, the shield is confined to the equator, so it's not very effective. Whereas at solar maximum, when the polar fields are reversing, that shield extends all the way from one pole to the other. So we see actually fewer high-energy cosmic rays coming from the galaxy now than we normally would. That's not so important for us here on Earth, but if you were an astronaut in space beyond the Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere, you would see a different radiation level. So if you were traveling to Mars, this is the time to go when those high-energy cosmic rays aren't there.
All right. Well, so this is a good time to go to Mars. You know, I'm game. I'm a little short of funds to go to Mars, as is apparently NASA. But What explains the fact that this particular solar cycle seems to be very, very weak, and it would have been expected to be much stronger, but they haven't seen anything like this in 200 years?
It's a real mystery, and it's one of the sort of disappointments of solar physics, that we haven't been able to understand the process a little bit better. Historically, this cycle, the one that we're just coming through, is a lot like solar cycle 14, 10 solar cycles ago at the beginning of the 1900s. So the sun does go through these different cycles of times when it's more active and when times when it's less active. But unfortunately, we're not yet at the point where we can actually make that prediction ourselves.
And at the very least, we can simply say that the sun is attempting to maintain some sense of mystery about her by concealing.
Well, that's what makes it fun to study.
Indeed. Todd Hoeksema, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Todd Hoeksema is director of the Wilcox Solar Observatory at Stanford University. So you'll recall we started this program by asking you if social media has degraded writing skills for you or your kids. And boy, did you have some things to say about that.
Hi, I'm Sanford Schumann from West Palm Beach, Florida. I've become a better writer. I communicate more. And because I know more people will see what I write, I edit much more. It's easy with the thesaurus and dictionary online and websites that give me information and fact-checking. I'd say my final product ends up much shorter but way more clear and I think more entertaining than it started. And the feedback is encouraging.
This is Joan, and texting and social media have definitely hindered my daughter's writing abilities. All communications with their friends is in shorthand with no punctuation, no capitalization. They were actually better spellers in fifth grade than now in high school. We even got them keyboard phones specifically to help with that, and I simply don't reply to any texts from them, which are not in English, except to maybe reply with what.
So a very concerned mom there and a smiley-faced adult writer from West Palm Beach, Florida. We promised that we would have a couple of teachers talk about their observations on all this later in the program, but we want to bring the teachers in right now to respond to some of your many comments. Andrew Simmons, high school English teacher from California. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
And Jessica Leahy is a middle school Latin and English teacher from New Hampshire. Taking a little time off, Jessica, but thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
All right. So both of you have experience with students. We want to hear about that a little later in the hour. But can you respond to the, sort of best case and worst case scenarios that our listeners related there, Andrew?
I would agree in some sense with both of the callers. I would say that the second caller is absolutely right. English conventions have certainly gone out the window as social networking, social media has become more prominent in the lives of students. I would also agree to some extent with the first caller. You might be writing 40 characters or less, but you are thinking at least to some extent about the craft of it.
So Jessica, would you agree that Joan, our mom there, is a bit of fighting an uphill battle trying to get her daughters to respond to the disciplines of language these days?
I think she has a point. Brevity is key when it comes to texting and email. We also have autocorrect on Facebook, but I actually don't think that many students actually bother to use the autocorrect because it's really about responding as quickly as possible and the rules of English language be damned. But I think there is a plus to be said for adults using it in the sense that I think we do have to at least consider the fact that we're going to have a much larger audience if we're putting something out there for mass consumption. I know I'm extremely careful with my work when I publish online, but I can't say that the same is can be said for the students' work.
Listen to this from San Antonio, Texas. I'm a high school history teacher. I do not blame social media for the kids' poor writing skills. The problem is that they do not read enough formal writing and therefore are unable to translate those skills. We need to get our kids reading more books in addition to their use of social media because it's not going anywhere, social media anyway. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, of course students should read books. I don't think social media is necessarily some disease that's going to prevent students from reading books. In school, students need to learn the value of reading. So teachers and parents and mentors have a job to do, of course, with respect to that.
All right, we're going to leave you with one last comment here.
This is Aisha from Auburn Hills, Michigan, and I'm a better writer on social media because with limited space to share ideas, sentence structure and word choice is extremely important.
Everybody needs an editor, Jessica, and social media constitutes that listener's editor. What do you think?
I'm a big fan of density in writing, but again, I have to say that I think that haste is the big word of the day when it comes to responding in social media. You want to be the first one to get there with the first comment, and there's a huge amount of rush in that. So I think the brevity issue kind of gets outweighed by the haste issue.
All right. Well, we will observe your experiences with actual students when we come back a little later this hour. Andrew Simmons is a high school English teacher from California, and Jessica Leahy is a middle school Latin and English teacher. She writes the Parent Teacher Conference column for the New York Times. Stay with us, guys. Keep sharing your thoughts about writing and social media. We'll come back to our teachers shortly. But let's recall your conversation this week about whether the booming stock market and the global economy is in another bubble.
This is Frank Wheeler from Goose Bay, Alaska. And yeah, the stock market is really scary. It's been artificially propped up with $85 billion a month in stimulus money for several years now. And when that ceases, it's not going to be a good time to have all your eggs in that basket.
In fact, Frank, there are some indicators that investors are pretty scared of the baskets out there and have turned to real estate as a safe haven.
It boils down to this, which is when you have risk in the financial sector, the banking system obviously looks for certainty, and it gets certainty in collateral. And the best form of collateral is property.
Faisal Islam is the economics editor for Channel 4 News and author of The Default Line, the inside story of people, banks, and entire nations on the edge. He's based in London, a place like New York City, known for its high-value properties and hot real estate market. But as we read today about the Federal Reserve increasingly leery about backing off all of its stimulus, Faisal Islam says there's a fascinating game of globalized monopoly being played out. And the street names aren't in Atlantic City, New Jersey. They're on the other side of the Atlantic.
So you may think the U.S. Treasury is the world's reserve currency, but we in Britain, we have a contender for that title, which is called a London condo. This has become a form of world reserve currency. Perhaps there's a connection where some people have seen some unthinkable doubts in the sanctity of the U.S. Treasury. They feel that UK property, or more specifically central London property, offers them that certainty of a store of value. It used to be the world's elite, the world's oligarchs, the world's oil sheikhs would come to London and they'd buy property in order to maintain it as a store of value. What's really fascinating right now is not that. That's always been the case and has been the case since the 19th century. That has gone into overdrive, and you have ever more elaborate schemes designed for that end of the market. But what's totally fascinating is that that has now spread. You pre-sell these apartments to not to the super rich of the world, but to the world's growing middle classes where the savings are. And where are the savings? The savings are in East Asia, in Malaysia, Hong Kong, Singapore. So you have UK real estate developers flying out to Hong Kong and to Kuala Lumpur, hiring out five-star hotels and selling maybe one-third, maybe half of entire developments in London off-plan in advance to East Asia's middle class. And we're talking doctors and dentists. We're not talking the super rich bankers of these places, because those guys don't have pension systems. They don't have social security systems. They don't have security of their livelihoods in older age because their societies haven't provided. So this is an amazing story of globalization.
You know, as a journalist and as someone who follows the economy, you could look at a system where the numbers don't seem to add up. And if it's working, everyone is a genius. If you're someone who warns that, hey, the numbers aren't adding up and it crashes, then you're a genius. But predicting when the fact that it doesn't add up is going to blow is really, really the hard part here. How vulnerable do you think the global economy is to all of the phenomena you describe that don't really add up?
I mean, clearly the whole of the Western economic system is still underpinned by super accommodative, easy monetary policy. And that's understandable in the aftermath of the type of crisis that we had in 2008. But we're 5 years on, half a decade on now. And people are beginning to wonder in the UK, as I'm sure they are in the US, which is it actually possible to put up interest rates for the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or the European Central Bank to put up interest rates? Are we so scared of what would happen to people with mortgages or small businesses or the banking system if interest rates went back up. It's almost like it's become an addiction. And it's a very difficult call for those central bankers to know when to, if you like, take away the medicine. And it's quite frightening for them to think about what will emerge when the anesthetic is stopped.
In 2013, what nation do you think could bring down the whole house of cards tomorrow?
There's a question. Okay, I think in Europe, what we've had is a fascinating series of examples of countries that have, for different reasons, fallen over. Greece, public sector. Spain, housing. Ireland, mainly housing. UK, a bit of housing, a bit of public sector. And it's my view that what you see in Europe now is, if you like, a shadow game between Germany and France. The old foes of Europe, now very much the driving force of the European Union. And all of the negative characteristics of the countries I describe are contained in some way in France. But France is too big for Germany to tell what to do. And the real question is whether France can grow, can shrink its public debt problems. Because essentially, if that doesn't happen, Germany will have to write a very large check to keep Europe together. This is a sort of 2 or 3 year thing. Everything you've seen in the Eurozone crisis is in countries that are irrelevant to the world economy, but they matter as an example for how Germany wants France to act, which is a bit more like Germany. So I would say check Paris out. It's a nice place to check out, but if the Eurozone fails, and my view is that they'll do everything it takes to keep it on the road. It's been a completely man-made source of economic fragility over the past couple of years that no one needed, that ricocheted all around the world. But the ultimate battle here is Germany trying to pull France into the 21st century economy.
Who do you bet on, Napoleon or the Kaiser here?
Well, you know, this is the interesting thing about Germany. At the end of the day, Germany is the reluctant imperium of Europe. They don't really want this role of calling the shots. And so my sense is, as Germany writes the checks, the German view on this will win. Because as we can see all around the world, it's the places where capital is abundant that do eventually call the shots, although sometimes that process takes a bit of time.
Faisal Islam, economics editor for Channel 4 News and author of The Default Line, the inside story of people, banks, and entire nations on the edge. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
A lot of agreement out there from some of you. Mark in Dallas has a thought.
After 10 years at Citigroup and AXA as a financial consultant, I had to leave. As long as we continue to use speculative investments as economic drivers, the gap will grow and people will suffer.
Speculate with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Let's go back to our discussion now of language and social media and the teaching of writing skills in our time. So many of you sharing your experiences, a lot of anxiety about emoticon speak, also a lot of enthusiasm about kids writing more, even if it is online. Back when I was in high school, the dangerous radical in my English class was poet E.E. Cummings. No punctuation, no capital letters, great poems, but my teachers cautioned, don't try this at home, pal. Here's a bit of Since Feeling Is First by E.E. Cummings. Since feeling is first, who pays any attention to the syntax of things? Boy, it's like he was texting from the very, very beginning. And later in the same poem, he says, life's not a paragraph. And death, I think, is no parenthesis. We want to welcome back Andrew Simmons, high school English teacher from California, who wrote a piece in this week's Atlantic about how Facebook is making his students better writers, and Jessica Leahy, middle school Latin and English teacher who writes the Parent Teacher Conference column for the New York Times. So, Jessica and Andrew, E.E. Cummings, is he a radical and does he kind of have it right? Feeling is first? Forget about syntax, Andrew.
I would agree with him that feeling is first when it comes to personal writing. The article I wrote was really focused on personal narrative writing. And I think conventions are incredibly important. Feeling has to be followed by a focus on the craft. But yes, I would agree with him that feeling is first. And before you have anything else, you need to have that feeling to start, that reflection and that emotional honesty.
Jessica, when I was in high school, of course, as I mentioned, E.E. Cummings was a dangerous radical, according to my English teachers, you know, no caps, limited punctuation. When I would say, can I do that? My teachers would say, you know, no. He wrote traditionally before he went there, pal. You've got to learn the rules. Jessica, what do you think about this idea that feeling precedes syntax on some level?
Well, E.E. Cummings also wrote another poem called Next to, of course, God, America, I, that also doesn't really use syntax and punctuation in the right way. But the problem is that entire poem is just one person spewing out a lot of things that sound great but don't have any actual meaning. And that's what I see a lot on the internet and in comments and in emails. A lot of stuff, a lot of noise without a lot of actual meaning. But I completely agree. Someone has to have the rules in order to learn how to bend them. And I also wrote an article for The Atlantic, and it was called Why Spelling Matters, because I think you have to know those basic rules of grammar and spelling in order to mess with them and make a statement with how you mess with them.
I'm wondering if you've said to one of your students ever, you know, dude, that's more like a text. Write it as a complete sentence. Andrew?
It happens once every day where I say, look, you know, when you write like this, I understand what you're trying to say. I do. And the person next to you might. But, you know, you need to understand who your audience is when you're writing academic writing. You understand that you may be judged for something other than your ideas or the feeling that you're putting into your writing, regardless, you know, depending on what sort of writing application it is. You want to be judged for your ideas, not for your inability to spell or use punctuation properly. Absolutely. That happens every single day.
Jessica, how about you? Do you get a lot of ranters in your classes and you have to kind of tone them down a little bit? Feelings are fine, but you know, let's make it coherent. Let's make an argument.
I actually don't tend to get a lot of ranters. I focus mostly on persuasive essays and thesis-based writing. There isn't a lot of narrative stuff going on in my classroom, but that's because there are a lot of opportunities to do narrative and memoir-type writing out there. In middle school, we're really trying to solidify their basic skills, and when we deviate too much from, you know, the basic four-paragraph, three-paragraph, five-paragraph essay, it tends to throw them off track a little bit. So we try to stay as consistent as possible in middle school.
Do you think kids are writing more? And does that help in some way in other areas of writing?
I think it definitely helps in their keyboarding skills. I'm seeing younger kids with incredibly wonderful keyboarding skills, which helps a lot later on. Many boys in middle school tend to have issues with handwriting. So when they have handwriting issues, dysgraphia, that kind of stuff, it really is nice to be able to express themselves as quickly as their brain functions in middle school and high school when they can keyboard really well. So I think that's been a huge leap forward for many kids who are struggling to express themselves in writing.
Do you think candor is improved by social media, Jessica? And then I'd love to get your comments, Andrew.
I think it absolutely depends on the kid. The joke around our house is the most I can get out of my kid in a text is yes or no. So candor, sure. Brevity, sure. But I'm not getting a lot of information. We have to go back and forth quite a bit to get the actual information. And he's 15. So, you know, brevity, great. Content, not so much.
Andrew, what accounts for your students unburdening themselves so freely?
Well, you know, I don't think social media is the only reason why, but when I'm thinking about the large-scale social and cultural change that might have made today's 17-year-olds a little more apt to be revealing in personal narrative writing, I would say that social media has to have had an influence. And because I have a teacher Facebook page and students post things that I see occasionally when I log on, I have noticed that students will put themselves out there in a way that I don't think my peers and I would have when I went to high school in sort of the mid-90s. And I do think that translates to the classroom. I do think that social media can give people this sort of safe space. I know it's not a safe space for real, but when it comes to, you know, revealing something personal, a problem that's being faced, some sort of anxiety that's going on, sometimes students can do that on the internet and get a little bit of positive reinforcement. And then when time comes to write, maybe they'll take that next step, the writing. I actually think personal narrative writing is extremely important. I mean, it's in the Common Core standards, but aside from that, I think it's important for students to be able to express themselves as well as frame arguments and analyze literature and do, you know, research papers. I mean, I know high school is very different from middle school, but I think it's important not just because students should be able to have that skill, but also students should be able to have that outlet of taking raw feeling, raw ideas, reflection, and organizing it and making sense of it and expressing it to other people so they might get something from it too. That's a good exercise for students and a good academic exercise.
Final thought, Jessica?
The one problem that I have with students expressing themselves in unique ways online now is that I think there can be a situation in which there's less trust, because if we do our jobs correctly as teachers, we should teach our students that nothing is really private on the internet when you're posting online. So I'm going to still trust in that one-on-one relationship between the student and the teacher. I know that my students over the years have revealed incredibly difficult and anxiety-provoking emotions on those papers that they hand in to me and put with great trust into my hands. And I'm not sure that they would do that in the same way when putting it out there into the world for anyone to read.
And certainly the consequences would be different if it's published versus just given to a teacher. Well, it's safe to say, that both of you are really on the front lines of all the transformations and disruptions going on in language because of social media, by virtue of the fact that you're in the class with all these social media natives. Andrew and Jessica, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Andrew Simmons is a writer and high school teacher who recently authored a piece for The Atlantic called Facebook Has Transformed My Students' Writing for the Better. Jessica Leahy is a middle school Latin and English teacher in New Hampshire who writes the Parent Teacher Conference column for the New York Times. Of course, we always want to hear from you. And is you a word or just a letter, you? Has the number four replaced the word F-O-R? From Flint, Michigan, Twitter's 140-character limit has helped me realize that I use too many commas. Well, that's a good thing. Catch up on any of the conversations on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.